Okay, so ready to dive in. Today, we're going way back to 1884 to a Supreme Court case that, well, it really stirs up some fundamental questions about, belonging, citizenship, all that. Elk v. Wilkins.
Yeah, Elk v. Wilkins, definitely a landmark case. It had huge implications for the legal status of Native Americans, and we're still, grappling with those implications today.
Right. And we've got some pretty interesting sources lined up here, right? So I guess our mission today is to, kind of unpack all this, figure out why a case from 1884 still matters so much in 2025, especially, when we think about citizenship, voting rights, the 14th Amendment. And of course, it's particularly relevant when we're talking about, Native Americans.
Absolutely. I mean, this case, it really gets to the core of how American citizenship law developed and how it intersected with tribal sovereignty, which is, well, it's a complex relationship, to say the least.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
So to make this a little more, I don't know, tangible, let's talk about John Elk. This guy, John Elk, he was born on a reservation right here in the U.S., but he decided to leave his tribe and he integrated himself into the community in Omaha, Nebraska. Like he lived there, worked there, the whole nine yards.
Right, he wanted to be part of that community.
And then in 1880, he tries to register to vote.
Makes sense, right? You're living
Yeah.
in a place, you want to have a say.
Exactly. But he's denied. Imagine that. Born here, living here, but told you don't actually belong enough to participate.
It's a powerful illustration of the legal barriers that Native Americans faced. And Elk's story, it really puts a human face on this broader legal debate.
For sure. So, okay, he's denied the right to vote. What happened exactly? Like, how did that go down?
Okay, so picture this. It's April 1880. John Elk walks into the office of Charles Wilkins. He's the voting registrar in Omaha.
Okay.
And Elk lays out his argument. He's born in the U.S., he cut ties with his tribe, so under the 14th Amendment, he should be a citizen, right?
Pretty straightforward.
But Wilkins doesn't buy it. He refuses to register Elk, saying that because Elk was born a member of an Indian tribe, he's not a U.S. citizen.
Wow.
And Elk, he's not giving up. He actually shows up on election day to cast his ballot.
He did.
Oh, yeah. But of course, they turn him away again. So what does Elk do? He sues Wilkins.
He sued him.
He sued him for, get this, $6,000 in damages.
$6,000.
$6,000.
Yeah.
Back then, that was a serious chunk of change. It really shows how important this was to him.
Yeah, that's not messing around. So, okay, let's get to the 14th Amendment, right?
Yeah.
That's the crux of this whole case.
Right, the battleground, you could say.
Specifically, that phrase, born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof.
Ah, yes. Subject to the jurisdiction thereof. That's where the Supreme Court really went to town with their interpretation.
And how do they interpret that phrase exactly? Because, I mean, on the surface, it seems like if you're born in the U.S., you're subject to its jurisdiction.
Right. You'd think so, wouldn't you? But the court, they didn't see it that way. They said it wasn't just about being physically present within the U.S., it was about complete political allegiance to the U.S. government right from birth. They
Well,
argued that simply being within U.S. territory wasn't enough. You had to be fully under U.S. sovereignty and authority from the get-go.
I see. So with that interpretation, let's unpack Justice Gray's majority opinion. What was the logic behind denying Elk citizenship?
Okay, so Justice Gray, he leaned heavily on this idea of Indian tribes as domestic dependent nations.
Domestic dependent nations.
It's a concept that comes from earlier Supreme Court cases, and it basically means that tribes, well, they have some inherent authority, but they're ultimately under the control of the federal government.
Oh, I see.
Right. And the court emphasized that tribal members, because they're born into these distinct political communities, they owe their allegiance to their tribe first, not to the U.S. So, according to the majority, John Elk, even though he was born in the U.S., he wasn't truly subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. in the way they interpreted the 14th Amendment.
Because his primary allegiance at birth was to his tribe.
Exactly.
So it wasn't enough just to be born on U.S. soil. What else did the court say was necessary for Native Americans to gain citizenship?
They were very clear about that. They said that for a Native American to become a U.S. citizen, there had to be some specific action by Congress, like through treaties or laws.
Right.
Without that, they said tribal members were outside the scope of the 14th Amendment's birthright citizenship guarantee.
Interesting. So basically, the power to decide when and how Native Americans would become citizens, it rested solely with the federal government.
That's how the courts saw it.
So what about John Elk's efforts to, you know, integrate into Omaha society? Did the court consider that at all?
Nope. They basically said it was irrelevant. Yeah. They said his citizenship status, it was determined by his allegiance at the moment of his birth. And since he was born into a tribe, which they saw as a separate political entity, well, his later choices, even though he left the tribe and, you know, lived differently, didn't change that initial status, at least not in the eyes of the law.
Wow. Okay, so this brings up another kind of loaded term. The idea of Native Americans as wards of the state.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
How did that concept play into the court's decision?
It was a big part of their reasoning, unfortunately. It's this this paternalistic idea that the federal government is like a guardian looking after the tribes, almost like they're, you know, children.
Right.
And it fed into this idea that citizenship for Native Americans was something to be given, not a right they inherently possessed. And often it was tied to policies aimed at civilizing them.
Which usually meant assimilating, right?
Exactly. And the message was clear. Citizenship is a privilege bestowed by the government, not something you're entitled to just because you were born here.
Yeah. And this whole thing, it also ties into the plenary power doctrine, right?
Yeah.
Which basically gives Congress almost unchecked power when it comes to tribal affairs.
Absolutely. The court in Elfie Wilkes, they were not only interpreting the 14th Amendment, but they were also bolstering this idea of congressional supremacy when it comes to Native American issues.
That's a lot of power concentrated in one branch of government.
Right.
But of course, there was a dissenting opinion, right? Justice Harlan, he didn't agree with the majority.
Oh, Justice Harlan, he had a very different take, and it's a powerful dissent. He argued that the folks who wrote the 14th Amendment, they intended it to be super inclusive, like everyone born in the U.S. should be a citizen, with very few exceptions, mainly people directly under the authority of a foreign power.
Got it.
And Harlan, he believed that once John Elk renounced his tribal ties and was living in the U.S., obeying its laws, all that, he definitely met the subject to the jurisdiction requirement. He actually saw Elk's integration into American society as a key factor.
So completely opposite to the majority opinion, which only focused on Elk's status at birth.
Right. For Harlan, citizenship, it wasn't a gift from Congress. It was a fundamental right that came with being born in the U.S. and being under its authority. He was really worried that the majority opinion would create, and I'm quoting him here, a stateless underclass of Native Americans.
People born in the U.S. but not recognized as citizens.
Exactly. He thought that went against the whole point of the 14th Amendment. But of course, Harlan's opinion, even though it's compelling, it didn't become law until much later with the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924.
Right, right. So for decades after Elk v. Wilkins, Native Americans born on tribal lands, they were denied automatic birthright citizenship. It really drives home the point that for them, where you were born wasn't the only factor.
Yeah, tribal affiliation, it played an overriding role in the eyes of the law.
And they had to rely on specific treaties or federal laws to gain citizenship, which, as you said before, were often tied to assimilation policies.
Unfortunately, yes, Elk v. Wilkins, it really set that precedent. And it had lasting consequences, not just for citizenship, but for the whole debate about tribal sovereignty versus the individual rights of Native Americans.
And this whole thing, it's even more striking when you compare it to another Supreme Court case. Wong Kim Ark decided in 1898. Can you walk us through that one?
Yeah, Wong Kim Ark. It's a really interesting contrast. In that case, the court ruled that children born in the U.S. to Chinese immigrants who were themselves barred from becoming citizens were U.S. citizens by birth. They leaned on that territorial aspect of the 14th Amendment. You're born here, you're a citizen. Pretty simple.
Okay.
But the difference between the two cases, it's glaring. It shows that birthright citizenship wasn't applied consistently, and factors like race and the unique history of Native American tribes in the U.S., they played a big role.
So Elk v. Wilkins, it created this this exception to birthright citizenship based on tribal affiliation, an exception that wasn't there for the children of immigrants in Wong Kim Ark.
Exactly. It really exposes some inconsistencies in how citizenship law was applied.
Big time. So stepping back a bit, what are some of the main criticisms of Elk v. Wilkins? Like, what do legal scholars tend to focus on?
One big question is whether the court's very narrow view of the subject to U.S. jurisdiction clause, mm-hmm. whether it really aligned with the original intention of the 14th Amendment. I mean, after the Civil War, the goal was to expand citizenship, guarantee equal protection, especially for formerly enslaved people.
Right.
And some argue that Elk v. Wilkins, it kind of went against that spirit. And they say the decision prioritized federal control over tribal autonomy to the detriment of both.
Mm.
And you can't really separate the ruling from the assimilationist policies of the time, which, well, they aim to break down tribal structures and force Native Americans to conform, often at the expense of their own cultures and self-governance.
It's all connected.
Absolutely.
And as we've said, Elk v. Wilkins, it didn't happen in a vacuum. It's part of this long, complicated story about the legal status of tribes in the U.S.
Right. You have to go back to Cherokee Nation v. Georgia to understand the context. That case, it established the idea of tribes as domestic dependent nations.
Right.
And Elk v. Wilkins built on that idea, reinforcing this unique semi-sovereign status for tribes, which had a huge impact on the citizenship of their members.
A domestic dependent nation.
Yeah.
So really, when you think about it, it's kind of a strange term, dependent within your own land.
It really is. It highlights the power imbalance at play.
For sure. And this tension between federal power and tribal sovereignty, it's not just history. It's still a major issue today, right? Like in cases like McGirt v. Oklahoma.
Yeah, McGirt, it dealt with jurisdictional boundaries based on historical treaties.
Yeah.
And it shows that these questions about tribal sovereignty, they're still very much alive.
Absolutely. So wrapping up our deep dive into Elk v. Wilkins, what's the key takeaway? What should we remember about this case?
The big takeaway is that citizenship, it's not as simple as just being born within a certain territory. It's also about power dynamics, about who's included and who's excluded, and how that's been shaped by history. The court's interpretation of jurisdiction in Elk, it really emphasized political allegiance at birth, not just physical presence or even later integration.
When they talked about subject to the jurisdiction thereof, they weren't just talking about being here. They were talking about who the government thought you belonged to politically.
Exactly. It's like, were you in their direct family, so to speak?
Right. And the court saw tribal members as belonging to this separate political family, not under the U.S. government's direct control from birth.
And that's where the plenary power doctrine comes in.
Hmm.
It basically says Congress has almost unlimited power over Indian tribes. So the court in Elk, they weren't just interpreting the 14th Amendment. They were also reinforcing this idea that Congress had the final say on Native American citizenship.
Right, right. So we have to look beyond just the text of the 14th Amendment and consider the historical and political context surrounding it.
Exactly. It's not just about the words themselves, but how those words have been interpreted and used.
Okay, so here's something to think about as we wrap up. How does this history, this denial of automatic birthright citizenship to Native Americans until 1924, how does that affect how we see belonging today? And how does it impact the relationship between the U.S. government and tribal nations?
It's a question worth pondering, and to really understand it, you have to look into the effects of the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924 and the ongoing legal and political struggles around tribal sovereignty.
For sure. It's a complex legacy that continues to shape our understanding of citizenship in the U.S.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Elk v. Wilkins. It's been a fascinating journey through a really pivotal moment in American legal history.
Definitely a case with lasting impact.
And we'll catch you next time on The Deep Dive.
See you then.